In this chapter, I discuss the introductory practice, which in the Anapanasati Sutta precedes the actual instructions for mindfulness of breathing in 16 steps. Besides trying to draw out implications of this description by reference to other discourse passages and pertinent later works, my intention in what follows is also to present a practice-oriented approach to this introductory passage. The progression through the 16 steps is a rather profound and sophisticated form of practice. By way of preparation for that, I take up the preliminaries to these 16 steps in considerable detail and endeavor to bring in additional perspectives that go beyond what is implied in the actual instructions. In this way, I hope to make sure that the needed foundation for proceeding smoothly through the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing is in place. The description of the preliminaries in the Anapanasati Sutta proceeds as follows. Here, gone to a forest, or to the root of a tree, or to an empty hut, one sits down. Having folded the legs crosswise, keeping the body erect, and having established mindfulness to the fore, mindful one breathes in and mindful one breathes out. The above instruction gradually proceeds from the external to the internal. First comes withdrawal to a place that affords seclusion. Next, the description of the posture of sitting down with folded legs, combined with the need to keep the seated body erect, and then the establishing of mindfulness. Central topics in this instruction are thus seclusion as the appropriate external setting for cultivating mindfulness of breathing, the posture to be adopted for such practice, and the need to establish mindfulness to the fore. In what follows, I examine each of these topics in turn. The first part of the above description mentions a forest, the root of a tree, and an empty hut as commendable places for the practice of mindfulness of breathing. Other discourses relate the three places of a forest, the root of a tree, and an empty hut to different meditation practices, making it clear that this description is not confined to mindfulness of breathing. In the ancient Indian setting, meditation would have regularly been done out in nature. Hence, a forest or the root of a tree naturally commend themselves. They provide some degree of shelter from the sun as well as from rain, and at the same time afford seclusion from the hustle and bustle of villages or towns. With an empty hut situated in a secluded environment, such protection becomes more thorough. In addition to coverage from sun or rain provided by the leaves of a single tree or a forest, such an empty hut also affords protection from being disturbed by various other living beings. The Bhayabhairava Sutta clarifies that the ability to retire into seclusion depends on having established a firm foundation in moral conduct. The discourse points to the relationship between lack of ethical restraint and the arising of unwholesome mental states once one retires to a secluded spot to meditate. This in turn reflects a prerequisite that holds for early Buddhist meditation practices in general, in that they build on a foundation in morality. In fact, the instructions for mindfulness of breathing are explicitly addressed to a bhikkhu. In the translated extracts given at the outset of each chapter, I have chosen to translate bhikkhu as one, in order to avoid giving the impression that the instructions are only meant for fully ordained male monastics. At the same time, however, these instructions are clearly intended for someone with a strong dedication to adopting ethical conduct and to living a life of renunciation of sensual indulgence. This does not mean that our morality needs to be absolutely perfect before even beginning to meditate. Taking such a position would be losing sight of the interrelation between these two and the substantial contribution that meditative development of the mind offers to improving ethical conduct. An increase of mindfulness naturally fosters a clear recognition of what is wholesome and unwholesome, thereby informing our behavior. Nevertheless, some degree of moral restraint has to be established first, in terms of avoiding major breaches of the basic precepts, in order to be able to go deeper in the practice of meditation. In addition to establishing a foundation in moral conduct, daily life can become an opportunity to confront gross manifestations of the five hindrances, which are sensual desire, anger, sloth and torpor, restlessness and worry, and doubt. To the extent to which we approach situations outside of formal meditation as opportunities to work with the hindrances, to that same extent the hindrances will not show up, or at least be substantially weakened, when we sit down to meditate. Conversely, if we find that we are being overwhelmed by hindrances and defilements during formal meditation, it may be commendable to try to work on inner seclusion during daily life and see if there is scope to strengthen it in a meaningful manner. According to the Visuddhimagga, a central meditation manual in the Theravada tradition, a prominent purpose of going to secluded places is to avoid being disturbed by noise. Hearing sound can become an obstruction, in particular to cultivating absorption. Concern with avoiding noisy environments is regularly reflected in the early discourses. The Buddha and his disciples were apparently well known among contemporaries for their preference for silence and quietude. In a discourse in the Digha Nikaya, the leader of a group of wanderers even goes so far as to scoff at the Buddha's secluded lifestyle. When searching for a place to build a monastery for the Buddha and his disciples, Anathapindika is on record for reflecting that such a place should better not be noisy, a consideration that eventually led him to choose Jeta's Grove. These passages imply that it is indeed meaningful to try to find a secluded and quiet place for our regular practice of mindfulness of breathing. From this viewpoint, a busy and noisy environment is not an ideal setting for deeply engaging in the practice. By contrast, however, it is perhaps even more important to learn to handle whatever noise still manifests during actual practice. It will hardly do to make our meditation dependent on the maintenance of silence by others. What emerges in this way is the need to combine a proper choice of the location in preparation for meditation practice with the proper attitude once that choice has been made. In other words, ahead of engaging in formal sitting, we try to find a secluded environment. Having done that much, we let go of any further concerns and let any sound that still arises be part of our practice. Making sound and other disturbances part of the practice can be related to the theme of sense restraint, Indriya Sangvara. According to the standard description in the discourses, sense restraint requires that we do not grasp either the sign, nimitta, or the secondary characteristics, anuvyanjana, of what has been perceived. Here, the sign stands for our first forming of an assessment, often already biased, and the secondary characteristics for further associations related to that first idea. The task is to steer clear of proliferating and reacting in ways that are unwholesome. The point at issue is not just avoidance. This much can be seen from the Indriya Bhavana Sutta, in which a Brahmin student proposes that to avoid seeing and hearing is the proper way of cultivating the sense faculties. The discourse continues by clarifying that, on adopting such a reasoning, the blind and deaf should be reckoned accomplished practitioners. With proper cultivation of the sense faculties, we stay within the domain of experience, but step out of reactivity to it. In the case of sound, a simple tool to accomplish this can be dropping any appropriation of silence as mine, something that I own and am entitled to. Such appropriation naturally leads to negativity, as soon as my privately owned property of silence is invaded by noisy others. Contemplation of the empty nature of whatever manifests at the sense door of the ear can go a long way in countering this tendency. In this way, the sign of disturbance need not be grasped at all, let alone the secondary characteristics of irritation and annoyance, resulting in the reactivity that usually follows. Any noise becomes just sound, hearing which can remind us of the empty nature of experience. Moreover, what we hear is sound arisen right now, which can even serve as a reminder of the present moment. In this way, sound need not be perceived as a disturbance, and can instead become an integral part of our practice, as we become better and better at not getting caught up in reactivity. According to a discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya, sense restraint leads to delight, paramojja, and joy, piti, which in turn are conducive to concentration. It follows that sound handled properly can become the starting point for a form of cultivation of the mind that eventually leads to gaining concentration, rather than invariably obstructing it. Nevertheless, the recommendation to retire to a forest, the root of a tree, or an empty place clearly presents secluded places as the appropriate setting for mindfulness of breathing. This description does not convey the impression that awareness of the breath was considered a form of practice to be undertaken in daily life situations. In fact, in the preliminary instructions from the Anapanasati Sutta, quoted above, mindfulness is directed to the breath only after one has reached a secluded place and sat down. For continuity of mindfulness in daily life, a preferable approach would be to direct awareness to the whole body, rather than to the breath only. The whole body provides an easily accessible support for establishing mindfulness and encourages a broad form of awareness instead of an exclusive focus of attention, a topic to which I will return in the next chapter. Daily life requires a flexible and open mode of awareness for us to be able to act and react appropriately in different situations. Cultivating such an open attitude, based on awareness of the whole body, can help in remaining centered when having to face different input through the senses. It can function similar to a strong post to which six different animals have been tied in such a way that they are unable to run away. Due to the post of mindfulness of the body being firmly established, the animals of the six senses no longer wander far away. The same mode of establishing mindfulness can come to our support even in the most challenging situation. The discourses illustrate this with the example of having to carry a bowl full of oil through a crowd at a dancing performance, and being followed by someone ready to cut off the head of the carrier if even a drop of oil is spilled. The carrier of the oil needs well-established mindfulness of the body to be able to execute this task successfully. In terms of actual practice, and going to some extent beyond what is implicit in the above passage from the Anapanasati Sutta, the instruction on seclusion could additionally be employed as a reminder to let go of our worries, concerns, responsibilities, and tasks when approaching the location which we have chosen for engaging in mindfulness of breathing. The idea is to tell ourselves that all such issues can be set aside for the time being, to be taken up again once the meditation period is over. Telling ourselves that now is not the time to be planning or making decisions can strengthen our ability to remain in the present moment instead of getting carried away into past or future. This mode of reflection can take inspiration from a passage in the Digha Nikaya that describes a king who retires from his duties to engage in meditation. Standing at the door to his meditation chamber, the king tells himself that thoughts of sensuality, ill will, and harming should stay right here and not come along inside. In a similar way, we might tell all the various things that could agitate the mind to stay at the entrance to our meditation space, not allowing them to come inside. Setting up such a no-entry permit can be aimed in particular at the hindrances. Parallel versions to the description of the preliminaries in the Anapanasati Sutta explicitly mention the need to overcome the hindrances before engaging in the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing. The same perspective also appears to be implicit in the fact that the 16 steps themselves do not show any concern with the removal of the hindrances, but appear to sit in at a stage when these are temporarily absent, a topic to which I will return in the next chapter. Understood in this sense, the topic of seclusion can be invested with both a bodily and a mental dimension. In addition to bodily withdrawal to a forest, the root of a tree, or an empty hut, seclusion of the mind from the hindrances can similarly serve as a foundation for the cultivation of mindfulness of breathing in 16 steps. In order to establish the mental dimension of seclusion fully, after letting go of our worries and concerns, we can check in on the mind to see if any of the hindrances is present. If this should be the case, we set up a clear intention in relation to the hindrances, similar to the king in the passage mentioned above. It would be better if you stayed outside and did not come inside. If we find that the hindrance nevertheless barges in and tries to disturb the condition of our mind, gently but firmly we send it back outside, employing whatever antidote we are accustomed to and have found helpful on past occasions. Besides specifying the locations suitable for the practice of mindfulness of breathing, the introductory passage also describes the proper posture. This requires having folded the legs crosswise. The depiction of the sitting posture shows that, at least from the viewpoint of the canonical instructions, mindfulness of breathing was considered a form of sitting meditation. This does not mean that there is something wrong with becoming aware of the breath in another posture or in an everyday situation. But such awareness could perhaps best lead over to and become integrated into whole body awareness. Rather than being the starting point for proceeding through the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing. The reference in the introductory passage to folding the legs crosswise reflects the typical way of sitting down on the floor in the ancient Indian context. From a practical perspective, the main issue is to establish a firm foundation for meditation with only a minimal need to change the posture. Instead of sitting on the ground, the same can also be achieved with the help of a bench or a chair. Regarding sitting on the ground, the early texts do not refer to sitting cushions, but only to sitting mats. These appear to have been simply a piece of cloth or a padding made of grass, leaves, or straw, spread on the ground to provide protection and insulation. Sitting without a cushion, to some extent, enhances the stability of the sitting posture, as the area of bodily contact with the ground increases. Nevertheless, it is important to avoid associating spiritual progress with a particular sitting posture. What counts in the end is the condition of the mind. Going beyond what is implicit in the actual instructions, the need to establish a firm foundation for sitting meditation through an appropriate posture can also be related to the mental domain. This can take the form of establishing a firm foundation for meditation practice through an appropriate motivation. It can be very helpful to formulate such a motivation in the mind before beginning actual practice. Perhaps right after having sat down. This could be an aspiration like, may I progress on the path to liberation for my own benefit and for the benefit of others. Setting up such a motivation provides a sense of overall direction as an orientation point. At the same time, it also arouses joyful inspiration, whose importance for continuity of practice can hardly be overestimated. As regards the actual formulation employed for such an aspiration, it is particularly commendable to bring in an altruistic dimension. This fortifies us for times of difficulty, as we are practicing for the sake of benefiting others and not just ourselves. It can also help to situate our meditation practice within the framework of the Noble Eightfold Path. The cultivation of the four satipatthanas, here in the form of proceeding through the four tetrads of mindfulness of breathing, is the seventh factor of this path. The second factor of the path is right intention, which has three dimensions. One of these is the intention for non-harm, which is an expression of compassion. Just as right intentions, based on right view, set the proper direction for a cultivation of the Noble Eightfold Path, so the compassionate intention to benefit others can set the proper direction for the flourishing of our practice of mindfulness of breathing. Yet another benefit of setting up our intention relates to the hindrances. Should the hindrance be present when we start with our practice, the formulating of our aspiration at this juncture can have the same function as the first in a set of five methods for overcoming unwholesome thoughts mentioned in the Vitakka Santana Sutta. This function is to replace an unwholesome thought with a wholesome thought, similar to a carpenter who replaces a gross peg with a finer one. In this way, any gross, unwholesome thought that might have been popping up in our mind can be replaced by the finer, wholesome thought of formulating our motivation. If there are no hindrances manifesting right now, The joyful inspiration that has arisen from articulating our intention will make it considerably less probable that a hindrance will arise subsequently. The need to arouse joy right at the outset of the practice is also recognized in the Visuddhimagga, which recommends recollecting the qualities of the three jewels, that is, the Buddha, his teaching, and the community of those on the path to or having attained one of the levels of awakening. Based on having established a firm foundation for sitting meditation in the bodily and mental domain, the next aspect described in the passage above is keeping the body erect. The sitting posture needs to be such that the spine is kept straight. Here, some degree of continuity of attention to the posture is required to avoid any slumping of the body. The Visuddhimagga comments that the spine should be kept straight, with vertebra resting end to end, to avoid the type of feeling tones that arise when the body is twisted in any way, which in turn would obstruct gaining unification of the mind. Keeping the body erect could be achieved by slowly passing our attention through the spine from bottom to top, relaxing each vertebra. Such relaxing enables a natural alignment of the spine by just letting gravity pull downwards. And the overall sense is as if the body were suspended from above, at the top of the head, and the rest of it relaxes downwards. The resulting erectness of the body is not something to be held in a fixed manner. Instead, the body remains flexible, comparable to a slender tree in the wind. Such flexibility allows for minor adjustments to occur whenever we notice that the body is not fully in balance. Needless to say, this does not mean we keep shifting around all the time, but just that we avoid holding the posture rigidly and with tension, be it when sitting on the ground, a cushion, a bench, or a chair. In order to be able to keep the body erect, we of course need to be aware of it. Thus, the present part of the instruction requires establishing awareness of the body as a whole in the sitting posture, and to some degree also monitoring it throughout the meditation session, at least until such a deep level of concentration is reached that the posture of the body naturally remains firm. During stages preceding such deep concentration, cultivating whole body awareness ensures that the body is kept erect and provides a grounding for the practice of mindfulness of breathing. Going beyond what the actual instructions say, the need for the posture of the body to be realigned whenever it is lost can be complemented by the need for the posture of the mind to be realigned whenever it is lost. Here the task is to stay in the present moment and avoid the mind succumbing to distractions. These two alignments could be combined in the sense that after having aligned the spine by relaxing each vertebra, we can set up the firm intention to align the mind to the present moment by relaxing any tendency into distraction. Setting up such an intention at the outset can serve as a way of telling the mind to keep a lookout for whenever the present moment is about to get lost. Just as we realign the body whenever its straightness has been lost, so we keep realigning the mind whenever it has succumbed to distraction and become overpowered by one of the hindrances. Due to the direction set by our firm intention and the previous groundwork, a mere reminder of our overall aim can often suffice to ensure that any hindrance goes quickly into abeyance. The passage translated at the outset of this chapter continues after the description of the appropriate posture with the expression having established mindfulness to the fore. The Vibhanga, an early Abhidharma text of the Theravada tradition, relates the expression to the four, Parimukha, to the nose tip or the upper lip. A more general sense emerges in one of the explanations of this expression provided in the Visuddhimagga, according to which mindfulness should be set up in such a way that it faces Abhimukha, the meditation object, Kamattana. References to mindfulness that is established to the four occur in other Pali discourses to introduce meditation practices that do not involve the breath. In such contexts, an understanding of the phrase as referring to the nose tip or the upper lip makes less sense. In the case of one such occurrence, where mindfulness established to the four leads to overcoming the five hindrances, the Chinese parallel speaks instead of mindfulness that is undivided. In view of these indications, it seems fair to leave it open to individual practitioners at which particular physical location they observe the breath. This concords with the general attitude of flexibility in the early discourses. One discourse reports the Buddha approving of a monastic's own mode of practice of mindfulness of breathing. Only after such approval did the Buddha explain how mindfulness of breathing can be undertaken in an even better way, namely by proceeding through the 16 steps. This shows that in ancient times, mindfulness of breathing was taught in a flexible manner, without the expectation that everyone had to practice in the exact same way. Although the nostril area is a natural choice for becoming aware of the process of breathing, the same can also be achieved by attending to the back of the throat, to the chest, to the abdomen area, or else even without relying on a particular circumscribed physical location. For those who prefer to work with a single spot, it can still be helpful to broaden awareness beyond that spot to the whole of the breath. The suggestion is not to follow the breath in and out, but to broaden our perspective and arrive at a more complete apperception of the phenomenon under contemplation. This phenomenon is the breath as a whole, and not only the sensation caused by the breath at a particular spot of the body. Encouraging a broader form of awareness in this way is helpful for the progression through the 16 steps. The instructions for the ensuing four tetrads of mindfulness of breathing do not explicitly refer to mindfulness, sati. The term only comes up in relation to the preliminary practice of establishing mindfulness to the four, and then being mindful when breathing in and out. This requires simply turning attention to the natural flow of breathing as it manifests in the here and now. Such a simple form of attending to the breaths brings out essential qualities of mindfulness as a receptive and non-intrusive form of mental presence with what is. In the Anapanasati Sutta, the meditative activities mentioned during the 16 steps are that one knows, experiences, calms, and contemplates. All of these activities take place in the receptive mental space that has been created through establishing mindfulness on the process of breathing. Their execution, in turn, supports continuity of mindfulness. In the Satipatthana Sutta, mindfulness is also not mentioned in the actual contemplations. An explicit reference to sati occurs in the part that I have dubbed the refrain, which comes after the description of each individual contemplation. In the Anapanasati Sutta, however, the reference to sati comes in the preliminaries, before the individual steps of practice are described. This puts an even stronger spotlight onto the need to establish mindfulness right from the outset. Once mindfulness has been established to the fore, experience at any sense door is met, first of all, by the gatekeeper of mindfulness. This relates to the topic of sense restraint already broached above, in that it is precisely the presence of mindfulness that facilitates not grasping either the sign or the secondary characteristics of whatever manifests at any sense door. Yet another dimension that could be related to the idea of establishing mindfulness to the fore is a first checking, by way of mindfulness, of the condition of our mind right now. Previous practice of Satipatthana meditation would have helped us become familiar with the texture of our mind when mindfulness is present. A brief checking in for that texture will enable us to recognize in what way practice is best adjusted in order to meet the mind where it actually is. Such checking in would also enable us to discern if the mind is sufficiently balanced to engage in mindfulness of breathing at all. At times, the mind might not be in a condition for this particular meditation, instead requiring other types of practices. It is also possible that some problem has manifested on the bodily level that interferes with natural relaxed breathing, or else due to some mental reason the body is in a cramped condition. Such a situation would make it advisable to opt for a different meditative exercise. In line with mindfulness as a way of tuning in to the present moment, it is important to allow space for such information to emerge and then adjust our practice accordingly. Once the gatekeeper of mindfulness comes to be fully at the forefront of experience, it can furnish the appropriate input, then enables guiding the mind from its present inner condition through the progressive cultivation of the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing or any other practice. The monitoring function of mindfulness as a form of meta-awareness is set up right at the outset of the practice, so as to serve as its foundation and continuous accompaniment. By way of preparation, it can be helpful to remain for a moment just with mindfulness established to the fore in this way, becoming fully aware of the quality of the mind when it is being supervised by mindfulness, before turning to the breath. This would be similar to meeting a good old friend whom we are going to be working with on some project. We would naturally take some time first to say hello and catch up with each other before getting into the work before us. The effect of similarly taking a moment to be with mindfulness is somewhat like switching on a head torch before going for a walk at night. In this way, we have switched on the light of mindfulness to shine on our meditative progression through the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing. The instruction for turning to the breath enjoins that mindful one breathes in and mindful one breathes out. This brief instruction delineates the main practice, of which the 16 steps are a more detailed elaboration. The task here is to discern with mindfulness the difference between inhalations and exhalations, which will be a continuous reference point throughout the ensuing meditative program. Such basic discerning is comparable to the instruction in the Satipatthana Sutta to be just mindful that there is a body, etc., for the sake of clear knowing and mindfulness. In the Anapanasati Sutta, the object of practice is the breath itself, first of all, and not only the sensations caused by the breath. The form of meditation we are practicing here is called mindfulness of inhalations and exhalations, anapanasati, and not perception of physical touch, pottabhasanya. Although physical sensations related to the touch of the breath are of course what helps us be aware of it, mindfulness of breathing is concerned with the breath itself. The present exercise requires giving attention to the breath itself, in particular to the distinction between inhalations and exhalations. This is the object of the meditation practice. For the purpose of such practice, bodily sensations related to the breath are only a means to an end. They serve this end to the degree to which they help us be aware of the breath, and in particular to discern if the flow of breathing moves inwards or outwards. In a cold climate, the inhalation tends to be cooler than the exhalation, so that sensing the temperature of the breath can also offer support for cultivating the basic distinction between these two. Whether attention is given to sensations of the direction of the flow of breathing or its temperature, however, the relationship of such sensations to the breath is similar to a finger pointing at the moon. The purpose of the finger is to encourage looking at the moon rather than at the finger itself. The distinction between the touch sensation of the breath and the breath itself is of additional relevance for cases when meditators are no longer able to experience the breath. This could in principle be due to two reasons. One is that the mind has become deeply concentrated, which usually occurs after considerable refinement of the practice. I will come back to this case in a subsequent chapter. The other reason is when certain physical sensations caused by the breath diminish to the extent of being hardly noticeable. This can already occur during early stages of practice and need not be related to a particularly deep level of concentration. When the breath is no longer distinctly felt, the Visuddhimagga recommends that one should not just get up thinking the practice is over, but instead investigate in the understanding that the breath cannot have disappeared completely. From the viewpoint of the approach to the practice presented here, it can be helpful to keep in mind that the object of the practice is the breath itself and not just particular physical sensations caused by the breath. Close investigation of what is taking place can lead to finding a way of observing the inhalations and exhalations that does not rely on the particular physical sensation that has become too subtle for being distinctly perceived. In this way, continuity of practice can be achieved. Later tradition distinguishes between knowing the felt sensation of the breath, considered to be pertinent for the practice of insight, and knowing the breath as a mental concept, this being appropriate for the cultivation of tranquility. Such a distinction is not required for meditation undertaken from an early Buddhist perspective. When we are practicing in a teaching lineage based on Theravada exegetical texts, this type of distinction needs to be followed to benefit fully from the instructions given. But in relation to the mode of practice presented here, this distinction could be set aside for the time being. The experience of sensations can help us recognize the difference between inhalation and exhalation, and to that degree we rely on it, knowing that our main object is the breath itself. We learn to use conceptual input judiciously, only to the degree necessary to foster clarity of understanding, in the clear recognition that our main task is to experience the breath, rather than imagine it or think about it. By finding a middle path in this way, the same basic mode of breathing in and out mindfully can be used to cultivate both tranquility and insight. Undertaken in this way, mindfulness of breathing can become a way of putting into practice the early Buddhist perspective on tranquility and insight as distinct but closely interrelated qualities. This perspective could be illustrated by comparing tranquility and insight to our two hands. These are distinct, yet they belong to the same body. Although at times we might use one hand for a particular task, often we employ both in conjunction. Some of us prefer to use the right hand for writing, but others rather employ the left hand. Trying to force a child to conform to the notion that one should write with the right hand can be detrimental to the child's growth. It is better to allow the child to grow up naturally and let it employ whichever hand it wishes to use for writing. Similarly, trying to impose conformity with the notion that tranquility has to be developed first and then only insight can become detrimental to our meditative growth. It is preferable to allow for emphasis on the one or the other of these two qualities, or even both in conjunction, to result from a natural unfolding of the practice. The insight perspective that emerges even with the simple practice of just being mindful of inhalations and exhalations is the direct experience of the constantly changing nature of the breath. A topic I will explore in more detail in relation to the fourth tetrad corresponding to contemplation of dharmas. Such direct experience clarifies impermanence in a very palpable way. As a manifestation of the wind element, the breath is probably the most easily discerned token of constant change taking place in the body. Besides being easily noticed, the breath also conveniently reflects the early Buddhist notion of impermanence, according to which things arise, keep changing for some time, and then disappear. This differs from the notion of momentariness prominent in later tradition, according to which phenomena disappear as soon as they have arisen. Rather than appearing and then disappearing on the spot, the motion of an incoming breath begins, continues for some time as a constantly changing phenomenon, and eventually the inhalation ceases completely. This is followed by a small gap, and then an exhalation begins, continues for some time as a changing flow of breath, and then ceases completely. After another small gap, another inhalation starts, and so on. In conjunction with this insight perspective, tranquility can be cultivated already with this preliminary practice of mindfully breathing in and out. The breath as such usually causes neutral sensations. When attention is directed to the breath, the mind easily wanders off, simply because the experience of the breath as such is not interesting enough to attract attention. The underlying tendency of neutral feeling tones is towards ignorance. In other words, we tend to ignore neutral feeling tones, as the mind looks out for some more entertaining alternative. Turning the hedonic dimension of mindfulness of breathing from neutral into a pleasant one, by cultivating the subtle pleasant feeling tone of being in the present moment, can go a long way in helping us to stay with the breath. I will return to explore this topic in more detail in the chapter on the second tetrad corresponding to contemplation of feeling tones. Undertaken in this way, just mindfully breathing in and out can become a way of cultivating both tranquility and insight, inculcating a basic collaboration of these two dimensions of meditative practice. Such collaboration can be pursued throughout the 16 steps. In this way, the question becomes less which tetrad should be put into one of two boxes, either tranquility or insight, but more how each step can offer its own unique blend of these two interrelated qualities. The basic mode of practice, where mindful one breathes in and mindful one breathes out, is the one to come back to whenever we get distracted. On realizing that the mind has wandered, we smilingly come back to noticing with mindfulness whether the breath goes in or out. As briefly mentioned above, a discourse in the Samyutta Nikaya reports a monastic describing his own approach to mindfulness of breathing, which the Buddha approved of, after which he proceeded to expound the 16 steps. In the Pali version, this monastic's actual practice, based on having cultivated a mental attitude aloof from desire and aversion, is as follows. Mindful I breathe in, and mindful I breathe out. The Chinese parallel has only the description of this attitude, without mentioning the breath at all, perhaps the result of a textual loss. Be that as it may, the Pali version clearly points to the need for some groundwork in order to emerge from defiled states of mind before embarking on the simple practice of being aware of inhalations and exhalations. Although the corresponding description in the extract translated at the outset of this chapter just enjoins mindful one breathes in and mindful one breathes out, without mentioning the need to emerge from desire and aversion, this can be assumed to be implicit. Just being mindful of inhalations and exhalations can become a summary of the whole trajectory of meditation practice to be explored in the next chapters. This practice requires maintaining awareness of the alternation between inhalations and exhalations, without succumbing to any distraction or hindrance. All of the 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing feature as a single perception in a list of altogether 10 perceptions given in another discourse, the Girimananda Sutta. Being mindful of the inhalations and exhalations is indeed the one perception that continues throughout the entire scheme of 16 steps. This is what they are all related to, and this is what we always come back to, being mindful of the changing nature of the breath. The perception of change is a topic that can conveniently be carried over into walking meditation. In this posture, awareness of the breath, cultivated during sitting, can lead over to an encompassing awareness of the whole body as manifesting constant change. This is particularly evident when we walk, simply because the body is in motion. The resultant shift to a more general perception of impermanence in this meditation posture goes beyond a narrow focus on the breath alone. Instead, the object of attention during walking meditation can become the whole body in that posture. Practice in the walking posture could serve as yet another approach to cultivating the conjunction of tranquility and insight described above. On adopting this approach, the task would be to note the impermanent nature of anything experienced during walking meditation, including the breath whenever opportune, and at the same time cultivate the pleasant feeling tone of being in the present moment. Summary. On approaching our meditation seat, representative of whatever degree of seclusion is possible in our present living situation, we can consciously let go of our worries and concerns, setting them aside for the time being, and then check in briefly for the presence of any hindrance. Placing our legs in such a way that they provide a firm foundation for the body in the sitting posture, we could also set up a firm motivation that informs our practice, to establish clarity about the direction in which this practice is to take us, and to arouse joyful inspiration. We briefly move our intention through the spine from bottom to top, to allow a natural alignment of the body. At the same time, we could also set up the intention to remain in the present moment, thereby in a way telling our own mind to keep an eye on the tendency to distraction. Keeping the body erect and the mind in the present moment needs to be continued throughout the sitting. as both can easily be lost. Next, we give prominence to bringing mindfulness to the fore. As a modality of sense restraint, we meet whatever manifests at any sensor with the gatekeeper of mindfulness, without succumbing to mental reactivity. Such a mode of practice naturally leads to the experience of the pleasant feeling tone of being in the present moment. Conjoining the pleasant feeling tone of being in the present moment to awareness of the flow of the breath exemplifies a conjunction of tranquility and insight, the latter taking the form of noticing the rising of each inhalation or exhalation, their changing nature while they persist, and their eventual disappearance. In this way, the preliminaries could be made use of in a way that already touches on topics related to the four satipatthanas. This is precisely the purpose of the whole 16 steps of mindfulness of breathing, namely to fulfill the four satipatthanas so as to lead, via a cultivation of the awakening factors, to knowledge and liberation. In the case of the approach to the preliminaries presented here, we have established bodily seclusion and cultivated awareness of the whole body in the sitting posture, thereby touching on the main theme of the first satipatthana. Having aroused joyful inspiration through formulating our motivation, we experience the pleasant feeling tone of being in the present moment, feeling tone being the object of the second satipatthana. This enables keeping the mind in the present moment and being aware of the actual condition of the mind, which is the central task in the third satipatthana. Mindfulness brought to the fore then arouses the first of the seven awakening factors, which are a central topic in the fourth satipatthana, contemplation of dharmas. Once aroused, such mindfulness attends to the inhalations and exhalations as an exemplification of impermanence. This lays the foundation for the rising of liberating insight, which is the overarching concern of any satipatthana meditation.